The question we raised last week was that Maimonides states that the rabbis of the Talmud, they condemned Antigonus because they said that they quoted an aphorism which is wise men be careful in your words, and they say that Antigonus was careless in his words because at his lecture he stated to the people, he said, do not be as those servants who serve the master in order to gain a reward, but be as those servants who serve the master not for the purpose of reward. And because of that statement, the Tzadok, who was the head of the Sadducees, and Bisus, who was the head of the Bathusians, is that what the transliteration is? The Bisusim in Hebrew. So those two people were listening to that lecture, and they walked out of the lecture, and they said what the rabbi said is that there is no reward for anything that we do that's good. So they abandoned the concept of the world to come, the afterlife, and they started on a route which denied this truth of Torah. In other words, they became apostates. And the rabbis blamed Antigonus for making that statement. Of course, the question, the obvious question, and Maimonides quotes this right here, and the obvious question is, then how come in the Mishnah, which is in the Ethics of the Fathers, they bring down Antigonus' statement in full? If that statement is so harmful, how could they, and they criticize Antigonus for making the statement at a lecture, so why did they preserve it for the masses? There were many things that the rabbis held, knowledge that they had, but they held it privately. This is no secret that the rabbis had knowledge which was secretive. And as a matter of fact, the Midrashim were never intended to be written down. And that's why the Midrash is so misunderstood, because the rabbis wrote in the form of parables, and a fool will look at it and just think he understands it because it conforms to his emotion. The reason why it conforms to the motion is because of the rabbis use the parable, but they think that the parable itself is literal, and therefore they corrupt the ideas. So the rabbis were well aware of the fact that you cannot allow all knowledge to be conveyed to the masses, and that certain things are only for people that really have the depth of understanding, and for others, you know, you teach them things on their level, but everybody is not capable of understanding everything. So that was the concept. By the way, that's the original concept of Kabbalah. The original concept of Kabbalah is mentioned in the Mishnah, and that is that there was a type of knowledge which was metaphysical, philosophical, and abstract knowledge which was not permitted to be taught to the masses. Because they would misconstrue it, they weren't on the level to understand it, and they would distort it and come out with some ridiculous conclusions. This is one of those cases where, that's why the rabbis say, the wise men, be careful with your words. Don't tell someone something that he's not capable of handling. Don't give him a piece of knowledge that he's not capable of handling at his level. You have to advance him slowly and in the proper way, but you cannot just... given an individual is not capable of absorbing a certain piece of knowledge, it might throw him, that one point may throw him off completely. And this is one of the cases where the rabbis criticized Antigonus, because he expounded at this lecture and he made the statement, and it resulted in two apostates. Tzadok was head of the Sadducees, and Bisus was head of the Balthusians. Now, the question, of course, is, so if that's the case, so this statement should have been concealed, and the rabbis never should have revealed it. Certainly, it should not be in the Mishnah. Moreover, Maimonides himself quotes it, and he says that they condemned Antigonus, the great scholar Antigonus, they condemned him because they said he made a mistake, but Maimonides himself mentions it. So why does Maimonides mention it? Okay? All right, now... whenever you see something like this, you know, it's like an open contradiction here. You know that there's something lurking behind the scenes here. There's obviously a solution here that is, you have to go a little bit beneath the surface. And I'll tell you what it is. Actually, what Maimonides is doing is he's using a very specific type of method which he uses throughout his writings in the guide, and basically it is a copy of the method used by the Torah itself. The Torah does make certain statements which have very deep meaning, but they're concealed and you have to be able to search for them. Okay? And Maimonides himself, in his guide, if you read his introduction, you'll see that he followed that kind of a method. And he says, in the introduction, he says that things that I wrote, some ideas are not for the masses, but he said, I conceal them in a way that they will never figure them out. The only one that will figure it out is the person who is on the level, and the proper level, and him that will enlighten, it will not harm. So the scholars continued to write in a cryptic method, which is really based on the beginning of Proverbs, where King Solomon says to listen carefully to the words of the wise and their riddles. And that was really, this goes all the way back to the Torah itself, because the Torah is written in certain places, it conceals certain ideas, and you have to be very astute to be able to pick up the hidden meanings. So this method goes all the way back, King Solomon goes back actually to the Torah itself. And it was the method that was followed by the scholars, and that's why the Midrash sometimes sounds so absurd. It sounds absurd because it represents certain concepts, and it's not wasn't intended as a literal to be taken literally. The reason why they wrote in parables and why the wise men spoke in parables, as King Solomon says, is because in one parable you can contain many, many ideas. So it is a very economical way of writing. The Mishnah writes the same way. The Mishnah gives one case, and out of one case you could have 20 halachas, 20 laws. If you wrote them out, it would fill several pages, whereas this way you can condense it into one case. So that's the style of the scholars, basically. Now, that's the problem today, by the way. Everybody reads Kabbalah and thinks they understand it, but they forget that there was an introduction to the Kabbalah, which every single scholar, Kabbalist or Talmudic scholar, agrees on, and that is that you cannot study Kabbalah until you've mastered Talmud. Because the mastery of Talmud means that the person has reached a level of intellectual capacity where he's capable of handling these ideas. However, of course, everybody always feels that they're ready to jump into the most abstract areas without any kind of... People don't like to hear that they have to have a... in order to learn, that they need prerequisites. Everybody feels they're ready for the ultimate secrets of the Torah. No one, if you tell somebody, I'll reveal a great secret to you, no one's going to say, well, I'm not ready. You see? Everybody, man's ego is such that he always thinks he's ready for the deepest secret, even though he has no real basis or training in anything. Usually, most people. Maimonides again makes this point in his very important point. He makes it in the Guide for the Perplexed, where he talks about on the study of metaphysics. But at any rate, let us get back to the question. Now, I will tell you what Maimonides... I'm going to tell you what Maimonides is really... The secret that Maimonides is concealing over here, and the same thing that the rabbis did in the Mishnah. And that is as follows. You see, Maimonides gives a little... an introduction to that point. And in the introduction, he gives a parable, okay? And he says like this. He says... that let me find it. Hold on a second. He says, just imagine before yourself a young boy. They bring him to the teacher to teach him Torah, and this is certainly the greatest good that you can do: to teach him concepts, ideas, knowledge, educate him. He says, but because the young boy is very young and he doesn't understand the good of education, he doesn't understand the good of knowledge. So therefore, what the teacher does is, the teacher tells him, and he says to him, look, he says, if you study today, I'll give you candy. So he gives him candy, or nuts, actually, Maimonides uses, or figs, things that in those days were used as candy. So he tells him this, and therefore the youngster is very excited, and the youngster does his lessons in order to gain the candy, all right? So he says, and then he says, because the youngster doesn't realize that the good is really the education itself, he thinks that the learning is very tedious and really something he'd rather not do. He'd rather be playing. But because the teacher promises him that he's going to reward him with candy, so he will be willing to spend his time studying and going through the rigor of the study in order to gain, to get the candy bar. He says, then he says this same youngster, he says, gets a little bit older. And when he gets a little older, so you can't bribe him with candy anymore. He says, then what you need to do is you tell him, well, I'm going to buy you new clothes. New shoes, new clothes, different things. Things that are really on a little bit of a higher level. All right? He says, and the teacher continues to use this method, because the teacher realizes that even at this stage, he still doesn't understand the importance of learning for its own sake. So you have to bribe him and offer him something in return for his willingness to subject himself to study. He says, then, of course, the youngster gets a little older, and you can't even bribe him with the clothes. So he says, so then what do you tell him? He says, then you tell him, look, if you study, you have a chance to become a scholar. And if you become a scholar, people are going to respect you. And people will praise you, and you'll gain prominence in society. So he says, so then the young man, he says, is moved by that. And he feels that, yes, it's worth it. I'll spend time studying, and then I'll gain the honor. So he says, of course, he says, Maimonides says that all this is really debasing, because the truth of the matter is that the benefit of study and knowledge is for its own sake and for no other sake. And he says that is the truth, and a person who is able to reach that level realizes this, and then he studies only for the sake of the study and the knowledge itself. He recognizes that that is the ultimate good. Okay. Now, the point that Maimonides is making here is that most people, as I mentioned last week, will always look for some kind of a goal, and they're going to do things for something else. Okay? But there's another point over here as well, and that pertains specifically to the concept of the afterlife. Alright? Now, the reason why people want an afterlife is not for the true reason. They're like the children, you see. They want an afterlife because a part of their instinctual makeup wants this afterlife. Alright? It's built into the instinct of man. Man doesn't wish to die. Man wishes to be immortal in some way. And people try to immortalize themselves through fantasy. Like people try to immortalize themselves through their works or through their actions. But man is looking for immortality. Now, that part of his nature that is looking for immortality is really the physical part of his nature. It stems from his instincts. It's not from his soul. Immanuel Kant made a big mistake when he thought that because man has a desire for eternity, that proves that he has a soul. That's absolutely false according to Torah. That has nothing to do with the soul. That really stems from the primitive part of man's nature, and the instinctual part that does not wish to die, simply because man conceives he does not wish to give up his pleasures, and the grave does not sound like an exciting place to be, so therefore he wishes to continue to live, and he wishes to live on forever. And it's like Woody Allen one time said, he says, I don't want to be immortalized through my works. I want to be immortalized by living forever. And that's a true statement. The immortalization through the works is kind of a secondary compensation. But it's based on the illusion and the fantasy of immortality in man, which does not stem from his divine element. It stems from his instinctual element. Okay, now, the point over here is as follows. That man's instinct desires to live eternally. Now, what Rabbi Antignos realized it. So he said, don't be like those who serve the master for reward. Actually, that's really a contraction of what his lecture was. Obviously, his lecture was more than that. It wasn't just that one phrase. In his lecture, he explained this concept. He explained that the real immortality of man has nothing to do with man's desire to be immortal. That these are two different things, two different worlds. In other words, his desire to be immortal stems from the emotional part of his makeup. Real immortality has nothing to do with that. Real immortality has to do with the world of knowledge, of sorrow, the world of ideas. As a matter of fact, if a person were honest with himself, he would never even learn, he would never study for that reason. Because he would realize that what he's going to gain out of the study is a different kind of immortality, not the kind he's really looking for. So in a sense, he's fooling himself, you see. Now this was the concept. This is the dangerous idea, you see, that Antigonus revealed in his lecture. When he revealed that, so there were two people there that listened to it, and they said, you know something, the rabbi's right. We've been fooling ourselves. We thought we're going to gain a certain kind of immortality, but we're looking for instinctual immortality. That doesn't exist. And we're fooling ourselves into thinking we're going to gain another kind of immortality. That's not the kind that really we're looking for. So once they realized that, you see, then they went one step further and they said, this is all a delusion. In other words, the concept of an afterlife is a delusion being used to fool us into doing these things. And who says that there is the other kind of afterlife? So they started to question, and they realized they had been fooling themselves, and they abandoned the entire concept. That's where Maimonides says that. That's where Maimonides says that you cannot. That's why they told Antigonus. They said, "Wise men, be careful in your words. Don't reveal to people who are deluding themselves something which is going to destroy them." You see, in other words, like this. Let's go back to the example that Maimonides gave with the youngster. When the youngster, you tell him the benefit of study is in order to get the candy bar. If you would tell him really that this is kind of silly. There's the candy bar isn't really the benefit of the study. So in other words, if you would not fool the child, he would never study. The case of the child, the reason why Maimonides gives the case of the child, is in order to show you, to demonstrate a concept. There's one line of thinking here Maimonides straight through. What he's saying is like this, that sometimes it is for a person's benefit to be deluded. And if you enlighten him too much, and if you don't fool him, then you will be harming him. Like the case of the child. In the child's case, you tell the child, well, you study today, and we'll get you a candy bar. So what are you telling him? You're telling him the benefit of study is the candy bar. But that's a lie. That's not really true. Now, if you wanted to be truthful to him, you wouldn't fool him that way. You would say, look, the benefit of study is not a candy bar, so I'm not going to give you a candy bar. I'm not going to tell you that's the benefit of study. That's a lie. The benefit of study is its own good. Now, can the child at that level perceive that idea that the benefit of study is its own good? No, he can't. So what's going to happen to the child? He's not going to study. Okay? So therefore you see that by fooling the child, you are benefiting him. Because it is a delusion, you're deluding him, you're telling him that this is the benefit of study, the candy bar, and you're giving him the candy bar, you're putting him in a situation where his mind is being fooled. He's studying because he thinks the benefit of study is to get a candy bar. That's a delusion. But if you didn't delude him, if you didn't give him the candy bar, and you told him the truth, you said the benefit of study is its own value, he wouldn't study. So therefore you would lose him. So this is precisely, that's why Maimonides gives that parable before before he introduces the case of Antigonus. He doesn't want to let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. He doesn't want to let everybody see it. And most people, when they read this part of Maimonides, will simply gloss over it and just will not pick it up. But the point he's making is a very simple one. And that is that the true benefit to man is the expansion of his knowledge. His knowledge of Torah, which gives him an approach to God, that is the true benefit, and that is that which continues to exist, because that is something which truly is eternal. The ideas are eternal, and that's the part of man that exists eternally. But that's only good if a person can have the appreciation. Because a person who doesn't see the joy in learning Torah, a person who doesn't see the benefit of knowledge, doesn't perceive it, and thinks that life is really, the great life is like the American society thinks the great life is. It's fame, it's fortune, it's pleasure. If that's what a person thinks is really the essence of existence, then if you tell them, well, look, you should study. You know why you should study? Because when you study, you're going to expand your knowledge, and that's really the greatest thing for man. They will laugh at you. It's the greatest thing. Greatest thing. You mean if I'm not successful, if I'm not famous, I don't have any money, and I don't have what we call success? Is life worth living? No, definitely not. They will say, and that's why people go into drugs and drinking. It's in order to escape the fact that their instincts are not being satisfied. Okay. So the point that Maimonides is making is that the afterlife comes in two forms. One form is a delusionary form, which should be employed. We should, in other words, as strange as it sounds, we should fool certain people. Why? Because people in general, before they can appreciate the benefit, the intrinsic value of Torah, we have to have some way to reach them. So therefore, he says, the afterlife is really a very good method. You tell them, you know why you should study? Because you're going to gain a reward. Not like Antigonus said, don't study for the sake of reward, which means he elaborated on that concept, and he showed them that they're practicing something which is delusionary. He should not have done that, because there were people that were not on their level to appreciate the true good, and they abandoned the other thing because they saw it was an illusion, and they just became apostates. Okay? That is the concept that Maimonides is disclosing over here. But he does it in a very cryptic way, so that the reader, the casual reader, will not pick it up. But once you see it, and then you read what he says, you'll see precisely what he's saying. Okay, of course, Maimonides concealed it for a very simple reason. For the same reason that the rabbis said that you have to conceal what Antigonus says, and for the same reason that when the rabbis quoted Antigonus, they really contracted into a very harmless statement that only a really intelligent person will understand what he meant. But the average person will say, we'll accept it in a religious kind of way. You know, that's true, we should serve God, not for the purpose of reward. It doesn't make any sense, because that's what they're really doing. That's their whole life. But they absorb it into their mind with all the other contradictory ideas, which don't seem to bother them once they're on a religious roll, so to speak, okay? But Torah was meant not just for people who are on a primary religious level, which is an unintellectual level. The Torah really is for the great scholar who sees beyond, a whole world beyond what the average person sees. But you have to be careful. You can't take an average person who has not been exposed to the true good of learning. He hasn't really learned Torah, doesn't know what it means to enjoy Torah, doesn't see the benefit and the light of knowledge, and you're going to tell him that, well, why should he study? Why should he do anything? So if you're going to strip away from him the fantasy and the illusion of some kind of reward in an afterlife, which he maintains because of his instinctual nature, if you're going to strip that away, what you're going to do is you're going to prevent him from ever coming to the truth. Just like if you didn't delude the child with candy and with clothes and then with honor, and you didn't tell him those things, he wouldn't study. So where would he be? He'd be nothing. So the point that the rabbis are making, that Maimonides is expressly explaining, is that you have to work with people on their level, and sometimes you'll find people that harbor an illusion. Don't destroy the illusion so quickly. The illusion may be leading them to an activity which eventually will permit them to go to a higher level and then shed the illusion in the right time. But if your timing is off, you can send them astray, and they will never be able to reach the ultimate good. So that's why Maimonides used that elaborate parable with the youngster, the little boy, and he gives the example of Antigonus. And he explains how you have to be very careful with this concept of an afterlife. There is a true afterlife, just like there is a true good for knowledge. But you can't tell a youngster the true gifts of knowledge, you'd be wasting your time. And unless you give him some kind of delusionary gratification, then he's not going to study. So it is wrong to take a person who is not fully developed and to teach him a truth which he's incapable of perceiving and causing him to stray from the course which would eventually lead him to a proper understanding and a genuine life of Torah, which is higher than the emotional religious life that he perceives. Okay? In other words, what my mom is saying is that I'm explaining to you certain ideas, but you have to be careful with these ideas because of the fact that not everyone is ready to understand what is meant by the true afterlife. They need an imaginary kind of afterlife, so leave them be until they get to the level where they're capable of true understanding. Don't be like Antigonus, who was careless, and he didn't check his audience when he gave this lecture, and he explained he explained that there is an afterlife which is a complete illusion, and once he explained that, there were two people that were incapable of perceiving the value of the true concept of an afterlife, and they abandoned the whole idea of Torah, and they became apostates. That is what Maimonides is saying. So the question, of course, is you should ask me a question now. Any questions?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm waiting
for a direct hit this time.
Okay, we're going to get a couple of direct hits. We'll probably have to turn the tape over before I get to the statement. I'll talk and Don will signal me and I'll go from there.
I'll tell you what. I'm speaking in Jeff. I'll tell you what my question is.
All right, go ahead and do your question, and then I will save mine because I've got a series that I want to ask about what you just said.
Okay. My question is, if that's the case, what right do I have to teach you? Because here...
That was going to be one of my questions.
Okay.
All right, and let me amplify that.
Go ahead.
If you take that idea or that philosophy that, you know, how can you teach this to the masses, then therefore you would have to, the logical conclusion of that is that you could never give public lectures in anything other than the simplest of Torah teaching.
No, that's not true. I'll answer that question too. You just tell me when to go, because I don't know what's going on with our tape.
All right, well, let's just stop now and turn the tape over, and then we'll go from there.
I have to prepare my questions, but I know.
Okay. All right. Okay. So when we get to the question there, now you say, no, that's not the case, but
I can't explain it.
All right, you're going to have to explain it, because I've got about 3 points under that.
Okay.
Okay, go.
So, 2 questions. The question is, first of all, a personal question. How could I give away this secret? I mean, when Maimonides worked so hard to conceal it, and the rabbis concealed it, now what right do I have to expose it? Well, the answer is like this. I believe that that a person has to make a judgment based upon his audience, just like the rabbis explained. And I think that a lot depends on the society that we're in. Now, if you have a society where they are committed to Torah, and you have a system of study where you go from level A to B to C, etc., etc., then it's true, you've got to be very careful, and you can't expose things that belong on level Z to someone on level B. Okay? Yes, that's correct. But today we don't have such a society. Today we have a society which is completely corrupt, and they're not involved in the ideas of Torah at all. So therefore, I feel that it is important to explain the concepts, because at least the intelligent people, you will reach the intelligent people. The other way, you're not going to reach anybody, all right? Because this is not a society which is structured in a Torah way, where you have a system, so to speak, which is being implemented by higher authorities and being guarded over and watched by people who are capable of determining how the educational process should point.
Okay. Excuse me.
So what I'm saying is, so number one, I feel that in our society, it is imperative that we do reveal some of the knowledge of Torah, because then we will reach those few people who are capable of understanding it, who are on the level to understand it. So that's number one. I feel you have to judge according to the society. Two, I feel that the people in the society that Maimonides was talking about were on a higher level. If they saw a contradiction in their life, they were able to change it. That takes a certain strength of character. Like, for instance, those two, Tzadok and Baisa. They said, well, we were operating under an illusion. Okay? Boom. I'm giving it up. Today, it's not the case. People who are religious, even if you show them ideas which are against what they believe, it doesn't seem to affect them, because people today are not on that level where they really are so rational that they make, that they're capable, that they have such strong character that they're capable of making decisions. So in my opinion, even if you expose, in many instances, you expose certain ideas, if they want to remain with their immature, childish notions, they're going to remain that way. They're not big enough to really make a change. So based upon those two facts, I feel that certain ideas, like this one, it is permissible to expose, because you will reach the intelligent people, and people who want to remain with their childishness will remain that way anyway. It's not going to really affect them too much. Okay. The next question was, the question that David asked was, that if that's the case, then we can't teach anything to people unless it's the utter simplicity. That's not true, because there is much knowledge to be gained in many, many areas of Torah that do not endanger...
Rabbi, yeah. I said masses, not just people.
Right.
Okay, let's, because right. You could teach individuals, but
right.
You, the masses.
All right.
Now, see, I learned that from you. I had to have my questions specific.
Okay, right. You can teach masses concepts, deeper concepts in ethics. You can teach them proverbs. You can teach them areas in the Torah that depict perfection in certain individuals and that will not harm them. I'm not saying you can't teach them everything there, because there are many concepts that are border on the dangerous, okay? But there are certain hidden areas, like the area of Sodom and Abraham, why he prayed for Sodom. There are hidden secrets behind there. But there are certain things that you cannot reveal. But there are many, many areas that you can reveal, and that you can take a person, the masses even, and show them concepts that are a little bit deeper than the ones that they presently harbor. And then again, you have the world of halacha, which is a beautiful world, and which is a world which engages the mind and develops a person's mind, teaches them how to think, and it is an area which is non-philosophical, so it can only benefit the person by improving their thinking and methods, improving their minds, and giving them a concept of God's halachic system, which is beautiful and which draws a person to knowledge, gives a person the experience of knowledge. You see, when a person has the experience of knowledge, you can appreciate, begin to understand what that means in an afterlife. But if a person doesn't have that experience, they've never experienced it, and going to a university, you will not experience it. It's something very unique in Torah. Then a person who has had that kind of experience, then you could move into this area. But you must first give them the experience. And there's plenty and plenty of material which one can teach the masses that would give them that experience. So there are many, many harmless areas. But an area like this, which is of major philosophical import, that has to do with the afterlife, which is a very abstract kind of thing, unless a person is into the infantile concept, but in the real concept, it's a very abstract idea. This is not something that you should be teaching the masses as the first kind of lesson. You don't start off with this lesson. It's something which, first, they must have the experience of knowledge. They must see the light of Torah. They must see the benefit of knowledge. Teach them Ecclesiastes. Show them the benefit of knowledge. Teach them Proverbs 7. Explain to them show them practically how an intelligent person makes wiser decisions and improves his or her life, and how a person without knowledge can destroy themselves. Teach them that first, and then you'll be able to teach them the true idea of the world to come. But you can't start off with this subject, even though, no doubt, this is the most intriguing subject. And if you said, well, we're going to discuss tomorrow, we're going to discuss the afterlife, you'll have more people than you would if you're going to say, we're going to discuss the concept of love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, the afterlife is more intriguing. But you can't do that. You see, you cannot go for sensationalism. You have to go for what is important for the masses to learn. And there is in Torah an orderly progression. We have to stick to that progression. You know, it's like Maimonides says in the Guide. You don't explain to people what an angel is when they can't even read a verse and plain for interpret and understand the basic concept of what a verse in Genesis means. I mean, can't do that. There's an order of progression here. So that's the point. But there's plenty of material to teach the masses. Plenty. The Torah is replete because the Torah takes up every single facet of human life and behavior, and it is endless. And there's no dearth, no shortage, supply of areas of knowledge. You don't have to jump to the most difficult, most profound areas first. Okay. Any other questions?
Maybe.
Okay.
All right. The point that I would make, I think that, and it's just a slight point of clarification, is that, see, what you discussed, I consider the halakha as the absolute basis, the basic fundamentals for quality of life. So you're talking about teaching them to the masses, and then you're teaching them the ability to think.
Right.
The point that I made is that the first point is that you could not teach the idea that you espoused earlier to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
You could not teach it to the masses.
Correct.
It has to be selective.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So we got that down pat there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then the second thing, or actually this is the third aspect of the statement, is that I think that we could train, according to Deuteronomy 6, 4, and, you know, through 11, that if we trained our children properly and they're lying down and they're rising up and as we go along the way, that I would say that we do not have to entice them with the candy or the drink or whatever, that we could reward them, but we would let them know that the reward is because we appreciate what they're done and not because they are doing it. Now, there's a slight variance there. There's a slight...
Yeah, but why should a person do it? He's not going to do it because you appreciate what he's doing.
Well, I think if they have the respect of the parent that you talk about, and you shall teach them to your children. Solomon says, train up a child in the way he is to go. So you can teach him from
that's the meaning of that verse, by the way.
Excuse me?
That's precisely what that verse means.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that we train them to learn for the sake of learning, and I would say everything else is incidental. That you do what your actions are based upon your knowledge.
Yeah, but you can't really, you see, if a person's not ready for, what you're saying is correct, but you're not really training them for the true reason because they can't understand what the true reason is.
I understand that, but see, I'm not going to reward them.
Well, you are rewarding them, but you're saying we're giving you...
I'm rewarding them because I see the ultimate goal, the end results, that if I am consistent and I'm teaching this child that he's learning for the sake of learning and not for the reward.
So, yeah, well, but the point, well, let me explain what you're doing. You're saying, let's say, for instance, you have a child and you train them that if you learn and you live a good life, that you have the respect of your parents and your family and your friends, etc., etc. That is true, but that's not the real reason to learn, because after a person dies, he doesn't have his friends and his relatives, and all these things are gone. So if a person was thinking into it, he would say, well, that's very nice, but ultimately, what do I get out of this? And is it really worth it for me to forfeit all my physical pleasures just to get the respect of a few people? Maybe get some other people's respect and get into the world of... get into the physical world. Get into the hedonistic type of life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see, what you're doing is the same thing. I mean, you just You're just saying that I'm giving him something else that will override the passion.
That's correct.
That's true, but that's not the real idea. That's not the real reason why a really wise person engages in learning. A really wise person does not engage in learning because he wants the respect of anybody. He engages in learning because it's the truth, and he knows that God is the ultimate reality, and he knows he's in line with God's reality, and he knows that in doing this, he's partaking of something which is eternal and superior to anything else that he can engage in.
All right. Well, let me give you an
idea. That idea is only possible if a person is advanced. If he's not advanced, you're going to have to give him something else. You may not want to call it a candy bar, but it is a candy bar because it's not the real reason.
Okay. Well, let me give you personal from B'nai Noach's standpoint.
Okay.
Most of the people that are involved in B'nai Noach come in one way or another from Christian backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
and we were given the little candy
right.
along the way.
Right.
And most of us that have learned, we learn for our own personal benefit for the sake of the knowledge of truth itself.
Well, that's a high level.
All right. So, therefore, to many of us, it would seem like a reverting back to a lower existence to do the type of thing that you said.
Oh, no, you shouldn't. I'm not saying.
But I'm saying that with our children, we could bring them in to the level.
Right.
That we are, rather than bringing them through this process. Am I making sense?
That may be true, but you're not going to tell me you could do that to a 7-year-old or to an 8-year-old. I mean, you're going to have to use, along the way, some candy bars, I mean, and hopefully by the time if the child is raised in the proper environment, hopefully when they are mature enough, they can do things for the right reason. That I agree with you. But you can't tell me you could do away with a candy bar totally. You can't take a 6-year-old and just tell him, the benefits of knowledge. I mean, he's not going to be able to consider it.
I think you can. All right, let me just give you again personal. I think if you take it as they say, and as many of us have done, our children, as we travel, as we ride, as we sit around the house, as we walk in the yard, that we are teaching them without really them knowing that they're being taught.
Well, that's true, but then they're doing it for some reason. They're doing it to please you. They're doing it because you're good parents. They're doing it for some kind of.
Well, I understand. I understand that aspect of it.
Okay.
But they're not going to just say, "Hey, Dad, shut up! I don't want to hear this."
No, I understand.
They're not going to do that, but
right.
they're learning.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's very good.
Okay.
But all I'm saying is that they're not learning when they're 7 the way they're going to be learning when they're 20. I mean, there's a different concept of knowledge that you have when you're 20 that you don't have when you're 7.
But if you have the proper respect for authority,
yes.
And that authority has proven itself through the years that they are in the learning process.
Right.
Then it's a growth process, and they're really not aware of the fact of the way they're functioning.
Well, then the respect for authority is the candy bar.
I understand what you're saying.
You're right, because the real reason to learn is not because of respect for authority. The real reason to learn is the knowledge itself.
Right.
So all I'm saying is that, my mind...
We are both agreeing, by the way.
I think so. You know,
yeah, we are agreeing. But we're just saying, I don't like the idea of the candy bar. I like the fact that I'm teaching. Now, see, if I followed your philosophy through, I could say, well, I'm teaching my children and other people because it meets some psychological need that I have to teach, and that I'm drawing some kind of pleasure from teaching them rather than just keeping what I know to myself.
Well, that may be true, but the point is that if a person has an enjoyment which is beneficial to others, there's no reason why they shouldn't do it.
Okay.
I mean, that may be so, but if the enjoyment is in line with reality, then we say, the Torah says, that by all means the person should do that. But the person should realize that there is a higher goal, and the person should always be striving for the higher goal. But we have to work with the goals that are within our reach. I mean, that's the point Maimonides is making. Like, let us say, for instance, a person enjoys teaching because of some psychological gain. So what should this person say? Well, I'm not going to teach because I'm doing it for psychological reasons. The person should estimate, should evaluate, well, is teaching others a benefit? Is this what God wants? Is this the true? Am I gaining out of this in a real way? Is my mind being enhanced by the teaching process? Am I thinking and gaining knowledge? Okay, so if I have a psychological enjoyment out of it too, fine. I should definitely do this. And there's nothing wrong with doing it, But hopefully I will reach a level where I am on a pure level, like a Moses, where his only motivation was knowledge of God. That's the highest level. We all strive for the highest level. We recognize our weaknesses. But when we have an emotion which is in line with a good, we don't say, well, hey, I'm not going to do that, because that would give me a psychological pleasure. Nothing wrong with psychological pleasure. If you're doing the right thing, fine. As long as the mind is, as long as you have a supremacy of your mind, then it is the proper thing to do. But once the emotion becomes the thing itself, then it's bad. And I'll give you an example. If a person enjoys teaching because of they have an egoistic joy out of it, then if someone asks them a good question, they're not going to be able to say, hey, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. They're not going to be able to say that. It's going to bother them. All right? So what will they do? In order to appear as if they have they know everything, they're going to give an answer which is not the correct answer. Oh, that's wrong. You see, there we're treading on, there the emotion already is getting loose and starting to function on its own. That's dangerous. That's not good. So a person can have psychological pleasure provided it is under the supremacy of his intelligence and he doesn't allow that gratification to distort his actions. That's really the way the Torah works, and that is certainly the proper way to proceed. But again, the person should have in his or her mind the ultimate goal of doing things for their own sake, even though at the level they are at presently, they cannot do that. In other words, we always say in Torah that we study great people who are far greater than we are, that we probably ever will be. But this shouldn't disturb us, because we want to have the sight set towards perfection, even though in our way we're not on that level. So we function we have ulterior motives or whatever, but as long as we are doing the proper thing and our mind assesses that we're doing the proper thing, there's nothing wrong with a person having a psychological enjoyment. Again, as long as it doesn't take over the personality. If that becomes the prime mover of the personality, then of course the person is not going to be operating with truth anymore. It's just going to be operating to satisfy their emotions. Then it's like a politician who tries to convince you that they're going to Washington for your good, when they are going there because they want the popularity, they want the power. So this is an individual who the emotion has really overpowered them. But if a politician would say, look, I enjoy public recognition. I like the approval of my fellow man. But my prime goal is really to help my fellow man, and if it comes to a point where I have to give up the approval and do what is true, I will do that. That is a good individual. There's nothing wrong with a person enjoying the popularity, as long as that's not their prime goal. When a politician is corrupt, is when that becomes their sole goal and their sole purpose. We don't care if the politician enjoys a little honor and a little popularity. There's nothing wrong with that, provided it doesn't distort their goals. And that's the same thing in all of life and in Torah as well. But we should also understand that there are people, and that a man is capable of operating solely because of the truth, and that's the level of the prophets, where they didn't do it for any psychological pleasure. They only did it because of the knowledge of God and knowledge of the truth. That's a very high level. We are not on that level. But it doesn't mean we have to cease to function or that we have to stop ourselves if we aren't on that level. Okay? Should I clarify that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you like that response?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I think we all have a grasp of it. The bottom line is we learn for the sake of learning, and everything else is incidental.
That's correct. I mean, I'll give you a little story. There was this is a rare story. It happened a few centuries ago. I don't know if it happened since. But there was a rabbi that was giving a lecture, I believe it was in Spain, and someone came in to listen to the lecture. It was a stranger that was an itinerant that was going from town to town, came in and listened to the rabbi's lecture, and he started, the rabbi said something, he questioned him, the rabbi asked the question, he gave an answer, and the rabbi saw this man has more knowledge than he does. So the rabbi gave a slap on the pulpit, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, this is your new rabbi. And he walked off, and that person became the leader of the community. That's a person of truth. This person may have enjoyed being a teacher, but he recognized that when there's a superior teacher, his place is to remove himself. That is a great individual. That's greatness. As I said, that happened many centuries ago. I don't know. Since then, I don't know how many cases like there were like that. But that's the epitome. That epitomizes a truthful person. Okay? So, again, I mean, we strive to improve ourselves and then to purify our motives, but at the same time, we do not cease to do the good, even though we're not on the level of doing it for the ultimately pure motive. Okay? We recognize the flaws in ourselves, and we observe ourselves, and we're very cautious, and if our emotions cause us to stray, to do something wrong, then we rethink it later, and we try to correct it. We try to correct the situation. Rabbi Soloveitchik, always prided himself in the fact that, and this was really really 100% true. I can attest to it because I'm a student of his. And he always said that one thing, he says, one thing about myself, he says, is that I don't take pride in too many things, but I take pride in one thing, that I will never distort a piece of Talmud in any way in order to preserve my own integrity. If I made a mistake, I will say I don't know. And if he catch me on something, I will withdraw. He says, and many times I could give answers, and he was quite brilliant, a phenomenal genius, and he could have gotten out of any question any way he wanted to, but he said, if I don't think it's the truth, I will not do it. And he mentioned that to the students because he wanted them to learn from his example, and I think that's one thing that he conveyed to all of us, and was 100% true. And I studied under many people, and I saw when they're in a tight spot, you know, they try to get out, and they can, you know, the human mind is very creative, but is that the real truth? Do they think that's really a true idea? They're just trying to preserve their own dignity and not to show that they've made a flaw. I mean, there is where you see whether a person is in control of their emotions or their emotions aren't in control of them. That's the dividing line. That really separates the two types of individuals. In that instance that you gave, you know, in the instance of teaching. Now, let me, if there are no more questions, let me return to the, and by the way, I mean, all of life, according to Torah, is the process of purifying our motives and our goals and being constant vigilance over ourselves. And if we make mistakes, we say the wrong thing, and emotion gets out of hand, we think about it later. I wrote about that this month's gap, the concept of repentance, and that's where that comes in, because we always fail, we always make mistakes, we're human, and our motives are not 100% pure, and we have to have vigilance, and many times we have to wait until we make a mistake, then we think it over, and we see just a minute, and we go back and we correct it. If we can't correct it in the actuality, we go back and say, look, I made a mistake, I told you this, I shouldn't have said that. We go back and we correct it. And if it's impossible to correct in the past, then we set our sights for the future, not to make the same errors. But that's what life is, according to Torah. It's constantly raising ourselves and purifying our motives and raising ourselves to higher and higher levels. That's really the concept of life, the objective of life in the view of Torah. It's not easy. It's not easy. That's why the Christians made a big mistake, because they said that they thought everything is belief. You just have to believe. Belief is not really the goal of Torah. If that were the case, you know, there's I don't know if you've seen, but there's Bill Moyer. This is a famous interviewer, and he has a series of interviews with this fellow John Campbell. This is very interesting. I was going to mention something else from it, but I'll mention this point. So he says that he was on vacation, and there was a priest that was laying by the pool, and he started to talk to him. So he asked John Campbell, who was a mythologist, studies mythology, an authority on myths and the primitive tribes and how they live, And, of course, he maintains that all religion is nothing more than an expression of these myths. So the priest asked him, he said, do you believe in God? So he said, no. So then the priest said, well, what if I prove it to you logically? So John Campbell said, well, he said, well, then, where's the concept of faith? So he said he taught him. He had nothing to say. But that's a total misunderstanding, because in the man-made religion, you always have to have faith, because there's no reality to back it up. So that's why faith is the foremost commandment, because without that, the whole thing falls apart. But in the true religion, the God religion, it's not faith, because if that were the case, then Moses, who spoke to God face to face, would have the least faith, because he knows of God's existence in a way that is so clear and so positive that it's undeniable. So he certainly doesn't have to have any faith in God. He knows God. So, and that is the goal of Torah, is where a person reaches a level where their mind perceives the existence of God. And it's not a matter of faith anymore. But the battle just begins when a person realizes that. And that's not the whole battle. For the man-made religions, that's the whole battle. Just I believe and that's it. But in Torah, it's an endless process of perfection. Yes, you know that God exists. Yes, it's true. And now, in life, you have a big battle now, because there's an instinctual part of your nature that wants, that's after vain things. And you cannot just get rid of that part of your makeup. You have to slowly, through progress and through knowledge, gain.